Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Larry Brilliant, who is an MD and a Master of Public Health. He's a former professor of epidemiology, a former high-tech entrepreneur, and a former public health official. On February 22, 2006, he was appointed executive director of Google.org, the philanthropic arm of Google. He is also the director and founder of the SIVA Foundation. Larry, welcome to Berkeley.
Hi, Harry. Thank you.
Where were you born and raised?
Detroit.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Good question to start. So I was a first and a half generation American. My dad was born in Russia. We used to call Russia, it was actually Belarusia. And my mom was born in the U.S. And I was the first person from either side of my family to graduate high school. And they were, it was very important to them that I go to school, and that I think they decided long before I did that I would be a doctor. It's a pretty common story, I think, from where I grew up anyway.
Mm-hmm. And looking back, you went to Michigan, the University of Michigan, but you were a philosophy major, right?
I was, yeah.
Yeah. So did you switch because of this high bar that they had set for you and your career, or did other things influencing you to move from philosophy to medicine?
Well, I never graduated.
Ah.
And my children remind me of that. I have two doctorates and a master's degree, but I don't have a bachelor's degree. And if anybody from the University of Michigan is listening, I'd still like to have one. Even though I was a professor there for 10 years, I pleaded with them to give me a bachelor's degree, but they wouldn't. So I went right from philosophy to medical school. My dad died when I was a junior, and I had planned to go to law school. So I applied to law schools on the East Coast. And when my dad died, it was there was no time for me to change easily. And Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan, where my mother lived, she had asked me to stay with her after her husband and her father both died in a period of a week. So I agreed, and I should have stayed with my mom in Detroit, Michigan. And the only place I could get into was Wayne Medical School. And I was very happy to go there, and it was a wonderful experience. But I never went back and finished my undergraduate degree, which my daughter reminds me of all the time.
Well, I think it's fair to say you didn't need it, actually.
Well, you don't know that.
Yeah. Well, so you.
I didn't know that at the time. Yeah. If I had been a bust as a doctor, I might have needed it.
So, but then you came out here for your internship, so out to the Bay Area, and we're talking about the 60s, really.
Yeah.
So I guess the question is, how did the 60s affect you?
Oh, not at all. Well, it wasn't fair. I actually took a summer job when I was in medical school to make some money, and that was the Johnson administration. That was the Great Society, and I took a job with the Office of Equal Health Opportunity, and my job was I was a civil rights specialist. I had a card that said civil rights specialist. And for some reason, most of my friends were sent to Mississippi or Louisiana, but they sent me to San Francisco. So I arrived in San Francisco with a civil rights specialist ID card right in the middle of the summer of love.
Mm-hmm.
That's not fair to take a boy from Detroit, Michigan, and send him to San Francisco in the middle of the summer of love. That's just not fair, and I don't think I've ever quite recovered from that.
Mm-hmm. But I'm curious. What was it that gave you this strong sense of social justice that you've carried throughout your career? Was that something that came from your family? Was that something that came out of the 60s, or all of the above?
I think all of the above. The school that I went to, the high school that I went to, which was Mumford High School, has produced a large number of kids who were social activists. I joined the NAACP when I was 15, I think. It was a time in which there was a movement. There were we and they, you knew that you were part of the movement. You knew when you met someone, they were part of the movement. You knew the movement was about freedom and democracy for poor people and black people and later against the war. There's another movement today, but it's a right-wing movement, and I'm sure that the people who are in that movement recognize each other when they see each other on the street. It's not a movement that I'm part of, but I recognize the power of that movement. So University of Michigan, when I was going to college, was a place where the first teach-ins were. The Port Huron Statement was being drafted in, while I was a junior in college. The idea of revolutionary change for the better, not guns, not that kind of a revolution, but a change for the better was in the air. Mm-hmm. And I think that most of my generation felt it, many of my generation, certainly in Ann Arbor.
And you, when you were here, you were called upon and chose to go to Alcatraz to deliver a baby for a woman who wanted to have her child on Indian soil. This was at the time that the Indians had reclaimed Alcatraz and so on. And that, in a way, was a kind of a turning point that led you away from being a traditional doctor. Talk a little about that. It's a lot to cover, but I think it's important to mention that.
Well, nobody else would go.
Yeah.
This woman wanted to have a baby. She was a Lakota Sioux. Her name was Lou Trudell. Her husband was John Trudell. It was very important to her to give birth to this Lakota Sioux baby on Indian-held land. There was no water, no electricity, no doctors. It was dangerous. Day after day, Herb Cain, the columnist, would write, "Is there no doctor willing to go? Is there no doctor willing to go?" And after three or four of those columns, I said, "Of course there's a doctor willing to go. I'll go." And it just seemed like, how could I not go, really?
As a result of that, I'm going to summarize here a little. You wound up being offered a role in a movie, what became a very bad movie, following some, as I've read about you. It's not.
I think it was
a
bad movie then. It hasn't become a bad movie.
Okay. And you wound up going on a tour with Wavy Gravy and others through the United States. You were to be the doctor attending them in this movie. And so this was another step which ultimately led you to go east. And we're not talking here about the East Coast. You went to South Asia. Talk a little about the evolution of your here you were, the traveler, I guess.
Well, the first thing I learned is how little the media can be trusted to know what they're talking about. As soon as I delivered this baby, or Lou Trudell delivered the baby, I just was there to assist. And then I got back off of Alcatraz. The moment I hit dry land, there were television cameras put in my face, and all of a sudden I was answering the question, what do the Indians want? And I was an expert on Indian affairs, having spent 3 weeks on the island. I didn't know anything about Native Americans. I was embarrassed at how little I knew. But suddenly I was on all the talk shows as an expert on Indian affairs. Which I think is a lesson for all of us. I don't think that part of the media has changed very much. And then I did get this invitation to play a young doctor in this movie, but they offered to pay for a clinic on Alcatraz if I did it. So it seemed like the right thing to do. We lived on a bunch of psychedelic painted hippie buses. The old expression was, you're either on the bus or you're off the bus. I was most decidedly on the bus. And we got on the bus in San Francisco, and we got off the bus in Kathmandu. Now, we have to change buses at the big pond, but it took us 2 years. We spent a lot of time getting a water pump repaired in Turkey and going through the Khyber Pass and Iran and Iraq. And I can tell you lots of stories. I think it's a very sad moment for me, though, because my kids can never make that trip. When I did that as a young American, I would go into the smallest, most remote villages, and there might be a picture of Buddha or Mecca, or if it's a Hindu village, a picture of Ram or Shiva. more often than not, on that holy, sacred place, there'd be a picture of John F. Kennedy. It's going to be a long time before there's a picture of another American president, certainly not this president, in those places. I was treated wonderfully every place that I went. America meant something noble and wonderful. It was like in all those countries we were a species apart, but like having a rich uncle who you sort of knew felt benevolently towards you. That's the way they looked at us. Even though we were the weirdest kids in the world and we were dressed funny, and I'm sure our living arrangements of 40 people living on two buses offended many different religious sensibilities, but we were treated so wonderfully well.
Now, you had become ill while you were at medical school, and so in a way, was this this journey taking you to the East where it was kind of an effort to discover your own soul and the means by which you would live your life? Was that experience, did that experience of being ill inform your desire to answer some of these big questions?
Maybe. I was certainly too stupid at the time to put it in such a noble context as you just did. But it certainly allowed me or forced me to change where I was going. I was going to be a surgeon. And I developed a parathyroid adenoma, which is either a cancer or a non-cancerous lesion of the parathyroid. In those days, the line was pretty blurred. And I had my parathyroid surgically removed. And then I was told that I should take some time off, so I couldn't go on to the residency program. So certainly the illness was the precipitating factor in my not going on to my residency. It is interesting because certainly the journey to the East is a journey of self-discovery, and certainly along the way I sought out holy men of Muslims and Jews and Christians and Buddhists and Hindus, and almost as every mile we went closer to India, another veil of the mystery dropped off. But I don't think it was because I was sick, but it certainly was the precipitant cause for my being able to take that trip.
Now you finally wound up in a Himalayan ashram where your guru is Neem Karoli Baba, what you were doing there was really intensive study of yourself, what you could learn about yourself, but also a serious study of comparative religions, basically. I mean, you were looking at the texts and asking yourself the big questions in the context of comparative religions. Is that right?
I still do.
Yeah. So it's something that you have maintained.
Oh, it's the only game in town. Yeah. Why would you do anything else?
Now, you are quoted somewhere in something that I read. I don't remember where I found this, but you say that he taught you, among many things, that there are people who get exactly what they want. You think they're lucky. This is the Baba talking to you. You think they're the lucky ones, but they're not. The lucky ones are those who do what they are meant to do.
Mm. It's actually a shloka from the Bhagavad Gita. And it's Dayato Vishan Pansaha Sangaste Shudsanjayate. And it is, essentially it says, your dharma, your destiny, however humble, is better for you than somebody else's destiny, however exalted. Mm-hmm. And for me, when my teacher told me to go work for the United Nations and help eradicate smallpox, it didn't feel right. I was wearing a long white robe and I had flowing hair and a big beard, and the UN seemed to be a place where you wore tight three-piece suits and pretended to be a diplomat. So it was a process for me to take off the one disguise and put on the three-piece suit, which ultimately was just another costume. But once I did it, and I realized that he had given me a chance to be part of a historic event, the eradication of a disease, I realized what a great blessing it was. So the process, I think, that you've described in that shloka in that quote is one of surrender. And you start to surrender when you stop believing that you know what's best for yourself and that your ambition to be something other than you are quiets down long enough that you start to listen.
Mm-hmm. I like to ask my guests about the temperament and the skills and the style of life that predominates in the work that they do. You've done so many things. So you, as I said earlier, you've been a technology entrepreneur. You've been the head of a non-governmental organization. You've been a public health official. You've been somebody in the field working to eradicate smallpox. And now you're going to be the head of a foundation.
Is that good or bad?
Well, I guess what I'm curious about is there a did from this self education that you went through. Are there a common set of themes that cross all of these roles? Or are they all so different that you basically we would have to go through each one, which we may not have time to do?
No, I think it's the other way around. You can kind of cut a pie horizontally or vertically, and you can look at someone's life logically in time sequence. In my case, after I first met my teacher, who was a Hindu, but who taught us Buddhist meditation, and he taught us to love Jesus and to respect Judaism and Islam, and it became different for me. I didn't deliberately search out anything after that. I watched as the things that came across my path, the way a river flows, if you're sitting by it, and I tried to feel the things that felt right. I tell my children that my life makes no sense at all, except in retrospect. They tell me that this new position at Google is the first time that my life has made any sense in any direction, as if everything else led up to this. It's a hard question that you ask because it's a spiritual discipline, and I fail at it 100 times a day. So I'm only good at telling you the failures. The successes elude me.
Mm-hmm. It is the case. Let's talk a little about some of these because I want to pick up some of these themes. You know, I actually wrote something down here, if I can find it, because I like to look at a person's life whole. And I said that you're a bridge builder who uses communications technology to acquire information and find solutions to mankind's problems. That struck me as a theme. And of course, it all begins with a kind of a respect for the other, which you got in this, I think, in this early education that we've just talked about. Let's look at some of the things that you did and see if that proves to be true. Your guru sent you out and said, go get rid of smallpox. India was a place and the surrounding countries where this could happen because the UN was on an effort to wipe it off the face of the earth, and India was key in that. And you set about doing that as part of an organization. Did you evolve in that process? Did the demands of the situation, and the situation was horrendous, and they were quite... Talk us a little about how you interacted with that environment.
Well, first of all, it's even more interesting, I think, than that, because when he told me to go work for the UN and work in the smallpox eradication program, and he said smallpox... In Hindi, he said, smallpox will be eradicated. This is God's gift to humanity. There was no smallpox program yet. Mm. And every time I would go to the UN and say, my guru who lives in the Himalayas has told me to come work for you, there's going to be a smallpox program, they would say, thank you very much for coming and send me out the door. And it was only after 15, 16, 17 trips that I bumped into D.A. Henderson, who was, in fact, the head of the smallpox program from Geneva, coming to India on a trip to establish that program. And how my guru could possibly have fathomed or been prescient enough to know that has eluded me all of my life. I don't know. I'd love to know the answer to that question. As far as myself, I was the mascot on the team. I was 26 or 27 when I started, and I was adopted by these giants of public health who took me under their wing, Bill Foege, D.A. Henderson, Nicole Grassley. They're legends in my field. And I was the luckiest guy in the world because I was just a kid. I'd never seen smallpox. I probably couldn't have spelled epidemiology then.
And this was hard work. I mean, the role that you played. I mean, I recently, just last night, watched the video of your acceptance of the TED Award, and you showed horrific pictures of what happens to a child who has the disease, and so this was about reaching a number of homes using the manpower of the UN. And convincing people of the horror of the disease and overcoming all sorts of cultural barriers. So this was a political, cultural conundrum where the science was very clear, the cure, the medicine was there, but a horrendous task. Talk a little about that. I mean, is there some way you can give our audience a brief feel for that?
Well, in retrospect, of course, I'm aware it was quite difficult. We had to make over a billion house calls. We had 150,000 people working in the program. We had 25 children killed by jeeps that ran over them, and we lost medical officers who died on boats, on planes. On everybody got sick. We always had dysentery. Many of us got malaria and pneumonia, and I got entamoeba histolytica, Hymenelopus nana, and a whole lot of other funny-sounding names. So in retrospect, it sounds terribly difficult. Hmm. But it wasn't difficult when we led that life. There's something about being able to work to eradicate the first disease in the world. And I was just recently in India working on the polio eradication program, which may become the second disease eradicated. And it's the same thing there. It calls forth something in you that's much greater than you are. And while it may seem hard, and these lists of things that occur are indeed very difficult, it doesn't feel like that. You feel blessed, privileged, honored to work in the program. I don't think any of us have ever been or will ever be as noble as we were then, or work as hard as we did, or been as smart or as dedicated. So it sure didn't feel hard at the time. We were exhausted. We could fall asleep standing up in the middle of a conversation. Mm-hmm. We were sick all the time. But it felt so good to be doing something as important as that.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wanted to get, there was somewhere in my readings for this interview, there was a point about the difficulty of going into a home and convincing people that this was an illness. And I guess that if a child got smallpox, the people in the house thought that this was the visit of a deity, and so therefore you shouldn't have a stranger come in to give the shot.
You've done your homework.
Yeah. But I mean, I raise that just to show the entrenched, in other words, objectively, this was a difficult problem, even though you and your teams may not have been experiencing that.
It was very difficult.
Yeah.
And the deity was Shitala Ma, the cooling mother. Sanskrit word for cooling is Shitala. And indeed, when the child had smallpox, the feeling was that there was the presence of Shitala Ma in the house. And Shitala Ma was propitiated both to keep away smallpox and to be kind to the person who had smallpox. So we actually were able to take that and make that part of the program by starting our surveillance efforts at Shitala Ma temples, figuring that people would have gone to propitiate the deity when they had smallpox. Mm-hmm. Sure, very difficult. I did things that I would never imagine that I could ever do or would want to do again. I was part of the American Civil Liberties Union when I was back in Detroit, and here I was in India breaking into people's homes in the middle of the night, forcibly vaccinating them, because they were spreading smallpox to the entire world. And there were some places that had become such broadcasters of smallpox that thousands of people were dying because that community would not allow themselves to be vaccinated, even though the law said they had to be vaccinated, or they had to go to jail, or they had to be forcibly vaccinated. So there were a lot of things that you have to use the whole nature of yourself in service to this amazing historic moment.
Mm-hmm. And these workers had to sometimes revisit these houses again and again to make sure...
We visited every house in India 20 times.
Yeah.
Every house, every month, for 20 times. Mm-hmm. Somewhere between 1 and 2 billion house calls.
Mm-hmm. Now, after this work, you taught at Michigan, then you established the SIVA Foundation here in Berkeley. And I gather that you were led to this because one of the consequences of smallpox was blindness, or could be in some cases. And so tell us a little, because this was now, so here you're moving from the UN and then the university to establishing a nonprofit that would address this problem of blindness in this part of the world.
Well, you told me earlier when you started doing these remarkable interviews that you were too young to know you couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was something like that. You know, nobody told me you couldn't start an NGO and try to eradicate blindness from the world. We had just done it for smallpox, so it seemed logical that we could do it for blindness. And we had seen so many people who were blind from smallpox. Smallpox probably caused nearly half of all the blindness in India in the 30s and the 40s. And even as late as the 1970s, smallpox still accounted for 7 to 10% of all the blindness in India. It's a particularly cruel double hit to have your face torn up by the lesions of smallpox and your eyes torn up by those scabs as well. And you can't look at somebody blinded by smallpox and not have your heart go out to them. So I think that's how we started. Plus, we had these two amazing people, Nicole Grasse and Dr. Venkateswamy, who were determined that we would conquer blindness. So SAVE is now 28 years old, and our projects, not us, our projects have given back sight to more than 2 million blind people, which is a big number, and we're very proud of that.
I get the sense as I look at your life in this hour interview that you really are a product of the Bay Area and have benefited from the network of connections that you have built up over time. That's fair, isn't it? I mean, funding and so on.
Yeah. Well, I lived in India for 10 years, and I lived in Ann Arbor for 10 when I was at the University of Michigan. But I was always trying to get back to the Bay Area.
Right. Yeah, nobody wants to leave. Yeah, yeah. So now the another theme that I want to pick up, and I'm trying to actually bring a lot of streams together in this brief hour interview. And you're a person also who's felt comfortable with technology. And I get the sense that you are driven by a need, but you recognize the importance of communication. And I think I get the sense that you moved into the field of technology, that you've seen technology as an opportunity to actually further these humanitarian goals. Now, there was a story which I thought captured this, which I read, which as part of the work of the SIVA Foundation, you had obtained a helicopter to do some study. Tell us a little about that, because your strategy here, and you say this again, you have to know the problem, find the solution. So as an epidemiologist, you have to go into places like Nepal and find out, you know, what the cause is, so that you can then have a strategy for coming up with a solution. You get a helicopter, the engine breaks. So then, what do you do to replace that engine, and how do you draw on this technology?
The first part was that when I was at Michigan, I was fortunate to meet a genius named Leslie Kish, who was the father of survey sampling. And he showed me how by taking a stochastic process in a random sample, not a haphazard, but a random sample of villages in India or Nepal, you could predict with very good precision how many cases of blindness there actually were, what the causes were, and then you could determine what hospitals had to be built, what medicines had to be delivered. The problem with that is that in Nepal, if you draw a stochastically correct random sample of villages on a piece of paper in Ann Arbor, then you go to Nepal, there are these things called mountains. And you hadn't really factored in the level of difficulty. And the only way you could get to the 108 randomly selected villages was with a helicopter. So we were very fortunate. We made an appeal to a helicopter company, the Evergreen Helicopter Company in McMinnville, Oregon. They gave us a helicopter. And after a little while and some adventures with the king, he finally agreed to let an American pilot with an American passenger and American doctors fly all over, and other nationals fly all over Nepal. It's very interesting. Before he let us fly, he asked me, "Are you lucky?" And I said, "Well, I think I am. Why?" He says, "Because if you're not lucky, I'm not going to let you fly this helicopter near the Chinese-Indian border."
I see.
So we had our own helicopter, and we were lucky, and we finished the 108 villages. And then on the last day, after we'd finished 108 villages, the helicopter did crash. It crashed in a very gentle way. But the pilot, I remember, as the helicopter came down like an oak leaf, as helicopters sometimes do, fortunately, as it landed, and Dr. Grasset said to him, what happened? And with the real white knuckles, he looked at her and said, "Nothing, just a simple spare parts order, engine one." So yes, we had to bring in a new engine. We had to determine who would pay for that engine. Now, we're in the mountains in the Himalayas, and we had to figure out how would that engine be flown in, how would the helicopter and the engine be matched, what would happen to the old engine, how would the old engine be shipped out of Nepal, and how would the helicopter, having been repaired hopefully, fly out. And Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple, had given me an Apple computer, and I linked it up over a satellite to the Stanford University computing system and through there to the United Nations and to the ambassadors of the United States in Delhi and in Kathmandu, to the helicopter company in McMinnville, Oregon, and the manufacturer of the helicopter in France. And we all talked on the computer about who would organize all these things. And as they say in French, voila, you know, 72 hours later, it was complete. Mm-hmm. We had had a new engine brought in. We had put it into the helicopter. We had flown out the helicopter, and we had taken care of the old engine. And in all my time working for the UN, 10 years at that point, I had never seen anything go so smoothly. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I became convinced that this new thing called electronic mail and computer conferencing was a really good thing.
And this was early. What year was this?
This was 1980.
Yeah.
It didn't exist.
Yeah.
This was the first time it had been done, and it was really, it's very satisfying to take that technology and put it in service to something so good.
Mm-hmm. As we talk about these many careers, I'm curious, getting back to this idea of temperament and skills, I'm curious about leadership, creativity, these two issues in these different areas. Talk a little about that. I mean, is creativity something that emerges because out of the situation? Is leadership something that, you know, once you're committed to what you're doing, once you recognize that sense of duty, you know, it's something that one undertakes? Tell us about that.
I don't actually think I do very much. Mm-hmm. If there's a big problem and you've got the right people with you, usually the answer emerges and you do what's the obvious thing to do. I don't really think of myself as some great manager or great leader. I think I've been very lucky to be in the positions that I've been in. You know, I meet a lot of people, and I've run a lot of companies, and I meet a lot of CEOs of big enterprises. I'm always so surprised at how much they seem to know. It doesn't always seem to be correlated to how well they actually do. So my experience is that people who are modest and who appreciate the value and the contributions of others really do a lot better than those who are constantly reaffirming what they think are their own skill sets.
Are these insights that you've developed over time, or are these things that you learned when you were in these retreats?
They're the same thing, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
They're exactly the same thing. So, There's no difference.
Yeah. So they may have told you, but you've actually learned it and actually going out and living it and so on. You were the founder of The Well, or made it happen. Talk a little about that as something in the technology realm that really reflects the same set of values in a way.
Well, when that helicopter crash happened, I became very interested in this new technology, which is then was called computer conferencing. Then it became known as the Internet or virtual community. So I came back, and I think I was trying to raise some money from Steve Jobs, and I showed him what had happened, and he said, "Hey, there's a product here. Why don't you start a company? Why don't you make money? And then why don't you fund all your charitable activities from the company?" And I said something really intelligent, like, "What's a company? How do you start a company?"
You're a movie doctor. You know,
what do I know? So that's what actually happened, is I started a company, and the most lasting product from that company is The Well, which is still alive and is still going strong and is owned by Salon.com now. And The Well was the first of a long line of virtual communities, America Online followed, Genie at General Electric followed. So it was the first, and it was a terrific success. Not because of me, although it was my idea, and I had to talk this guy into doing it, but the guy that I talked into doing it was Stuart Brand, who was the founder of the Whole Earth Catalog and is a genius at building communities, and he actually did everything. Other than that first conversation and giving him the money and the computers, I didn't do a damn thing. Mm-hmm. And it really was a terrific success, and certainly it's become a legend.
Mm-hmm. We were on a trajectory where the world seemed to be getting better and better. And then, 9/11 came along. The people who follow these trends, where we had to confront the reality that this technology and all the ideals that we thought we were realizing could be turned on their head. And I know that you, as somebody who had worked on smallpox, were then became involved with at the Centers of Disease Control to look at that as a potential terrorist weapon and what could be done about it. What was that like for you to suddenly realize that all of where we thought we were going could be turned on its head?
Well, I have two separate responses. The first is, as you say, when I saw those young firemen running up the stairs while everybody else ran down to escape from the towers, it affected me very deeply, and I quit all my corporate boards and I went down to CDC and I offered to help set up a program in the unlikely event that someone would get their hands on some smallpox and use it as an instrument of bioterrorism. So certainly what you say is true. The only issue that I would have is I don't think the trajectory of things getting better ended with 9/11. I think they ended with our response to 9/11. And 9/11 was a horrific criminal act. The problem began when, instead of going after the criminals or the criminal conspiracy that had created that, we made one of the worst mistakes that I think we've made as a nation. I love this country more than life itself. But for us to take that horrible crime that was committed against us and suddenly convert it into a war and then launch our missiles and our bombs at the wrong combatants began a series of events that we shall not recover from for generations. Mm-hmm. Immediately after 9/11, we were the most beloved nation in the world. I mean, I could barely stop from crying because everybody, their hearts opened up for us. And what we've done is we've squandered that. So I'm not so sure the trajectory changed with 9/11, but certainly it has changed now.
So our role in that trajectory has changed, which becomes part of the problem. You said recently somewhere, I think it was in an interview or in a speech, we're again in a war against hate and intolerance and violence coming from outside. And just as important, we are in a war against our own ignorance and our own arrogance right here inside America.
You know, 80% of U.S. congressmen did not have passports at the time they were elected to Congress. Think about that.
Mm-hmm. And yet, mind-boggling.
And yet we're the most powerful nation on earth. We're the most powerful nation that has ever existed, and I say thank God for that. However, and there is a however, after the Second World War, nobody behaved as well as we behaved as an occupying army. You can go all the way back to Thucydides. There's never been a nation which in victory treated the vanquished as kindly, and I would say as lovingly, and as generously as we did after the Second World War. Think of the Marshall Plan. Think of what we did to bring Germany and even Japan. They were our enemies. It's different now. After the Second World War, the rest of the world wanted there to be a single superpower, us. In fact, there's a Reuters poll that's taken every year, and from 1945 until the second year of the Bush administration, every year that poll, which is taken by 100 different countries, every year they said, we only want there to be one superpower, just the U.S. They're the good cops. Mm-hmm. Now, it's completely reversed. We are, by some measure, the most despised nation in the world. And only one country still wants there to be just one superpower, and you may not guess who that is. That's Japan, because mm-hmm. I think they think the other superpower might be China. Mm-hmm. So we've done something incalculably wrong. It's a bit like an autoimmune response. You know, you hear about bird flu, that people who die from bird flu are the ones sometimes who have the strongest immune system. Hmm. We have such a strong immune system because we have a good military, because we're very smart, and I think we're a wonderful country. But 9/11 was like a virus infecting us, and our immune system overreacted, and in that mode we are still reacting. So we're not aware of anything else in the world right now. It'll take a long time for the scales to equilibrate. I spent a lot of time visiting people's homes in Mississippi and in New Orleans and in Florida, and I've had a chance to talk to a lot of people. Everybody is beginning to question now who we are, what we want to be. We sort of know something's gone terribly wrong. We might all have different definitions or descriptions for what it is, but I'm confident we'll figure it out. We'll get it right.
It seems that in your past work and probably your future work that you are very focused on posing the right question and finding the best answers, then a solution, and then acting on it. You said recently also what is worthy of discussion is the world is now changing so much because of the trajectory of technology that we need to examine all our hypotheses and theories about infrastructure, politics, science, morality, you know, and religion. So in your past body of work, and you know, you've done soul work, I guess you would say. What is the way we go about, you know, sort of doing it? Is it only a mind thing, bringing the best minds together to think over issues, but there must be a people element to this too. And you talk a lot about love. I'm just curious, what is it that we that is a strategy for to address some of these problems.
I attended a remarkable meeting day before yesterday. It was a meeting convened by Muslim clerics, Imam Khorasani from Fairfax. He's a Shiite imam. And these 12 or 13 Islamic teachers and imams know that the violence, which has, like a virus, infected Islam, is destroying Islam and debilitating Islam. And so they wanted to have a meeting and talk about how do they confront radicalism, extremism, fundamentalism, and violence within Islam. And surprisingly, and maybe not so surprisingly, the person that they asked to arbitrate or convene was His Holiness the Dalai Lama, a Buddhist monk. So a meeting was convened in San Francisco that was chaired by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and he brought rabbis and he brought fundamentalist Christians, and he brought Catholics and Hindus and other Buddhists, and very quickly it became an interfaith conversation, and it moved from violence just in Islam to violence in all the religions. And isn't that one of the major things that are facing us today in the world? So your question is it inner work or is it outer work that deals with the real problems? One of the biggest problems that we face as a world is religious violence. I don't think that can be solved without inner work. And I don't think it can be solved without trust and deep fellowship. You know, I've had the pleasure of meeting some of the right-wing Christian fundamentalists who have taken as an act of Christian stewardship the need to help stop the world from escalating into global warming and the climate crisis. And in doing that, they're risking contamination with liberal enviros. But their Christian teachings, out of a deep commitment to stewardship, which comes out of their belief in Jesus as a teacher, they have taken this radical break. They're some of the most wonderful people in the world. You should meet these 84 theologians who are risking everything in their communities because they think that the world is going in the wrong direction. And I love those people. I take my strength from people like those fundamentalist preachers, from the Dalai Lama, from the imams and the rabbis who recognize the problems that they have to deal with. These are tough times, and we're all privileged to meet people who are struggling in that way and talking openly and honestly about the problems that they face.
I'll read this quote from you. You said somewhere, if you don't put the spiritual and religious dimension into our political conversation, you won't be asking the really big and important questions. If you don't bring in values and religion, you'll be asking superficial questions. What is life all about? What is our relationship to God? These are the important questions. What is our obligation to one another in community? If we don't ask those questions, the residual questions that we're asking aren't as interesting, basically. So one really has to go after those big questions. Why have we lost that, do you think?
Don't you think it's important?
Oh yeah, I agree. I'm not disagreeing. I am curious. Why has this conversation not been a steady staple, and why has it been subverted by people who want to use religion to get votes?
Wait, do you know about monocropping?
No. But
so when you're When you're a farmer and you're trying to plow your field and you're trying to grow grain, if you were just growing it for your family and a small community, you'd have carrots and you'd have peas and you'd have some potatoes and maybe you'd have a little bit of corn and you'd try to have a balanced meal all out in your field. But if you're making it for export, if you're trying to get to scale, it's so much better to just do sugarcane or just do corn and to monocrop. And I think what's happened is the pluralistic dialogues that are so fertile, the kind that you're talking about, the kind that I watched with the Dalai Lama and these imams, these pluralistic dialogues, they imply that there are many paths to God, that there are many paths to realization, that it's okay if you're going on university and I'm going to go on Hearst Street, but we're ultimately all going to get to the freeway. If you monocrop, there's no room for that. Straight furrows, big tractors, moving fast in one direction. No time to talk. I don't think you can get to the really interesting questions unless you're willing to listen, unless you're willing to have pluralism, unless you're willing to find out that someone else's path and method has some deep truth that you can learn from. Otherwise, we're all going to be like little advertisements standing up with a sign that says, I'm red, I'm blue. It'll look a little bit like the big game. Mm-hmm. You'll be for Stanford, I'll be for Berkeley, and we'll forget everything about why we went there in the first place. Mm-hmm. By the way, I'm not against football, but I'm just saying...
That's right.
I'm just saying, we've gotten too carried away, haven't we?
Yeah.
You know it. Everybody knows it. We all feel it. We've lost the ability to engage in meaningful conversation. We don't listen. We don't go into a conversation thinking that the other person has something to offer. We're selling. We're looking for somebody who's buying.
In our conversation, you used a number of public health scientific metaphors, and I'm just curious: has the reconciling of the spiritual, the soul work with the scientific, has that been a fulfilling task? Is there a tension? Talk a little about that dynamic.
It is fulfilling. I mean, if you believe that God is the summation of all goodness, then working in public health, trying to improve the health of the public, it feels a little bit like God's work. It's very satisfying. Yeah, I don't think I've ever thought of it quite that way, but it's very satisfying.
Let me ask you this. Students will probably watch this brief recounting of this journey that you've been on. What advice would you give them about drawing on your own experience to prepare for the future?
There's so many different levels to answer that question. First, I would say politically, love this country with all of its flaws. We're lucky to be here. We're lucky to be Americans. We inherit an opportunity that many people in the world will never have. And love it in a way that famous senator from Wisconsin said when on the floor of the Senate, he said, "My country, right or wrong? My country, when right, to be followed, when wrong, to be fixed." Politically, that's the way I feel. I love this country so much, but when it's not right, we have to work politically to fix it. Spiritually, be open to everybody. Your next is like Kurt Vonnegut, you know, dancing lessons. What is Kurt Vonnegut said? Peculiar travel suggestions or dancing lessons from God. Listen carefully, because you don't know where your next instruction will come from. And take yourself lightly. There's a wonderful radio commentator called The Razor on local sports television, and he says, angels fly because they take themselves lightly.
Larry, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to be here with us today, and we wish you thank you for coming to the campus to deliver the Elberg Lecture, and we wish you best of luck as you continue to fulfill your guru's advice to be one of the lucky ones, one of those who do what they were meant to do.
Thank you, Harry.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.